Welcome to another edition of The Wizard's Edge with the wizard himself, Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, consumer advocate. Jay, it's good to be talking to you again. I am really excited about our topic today.
Marty, I'm excited also. I think this is going to be one of the most application, not only specific, but important subject areas we've ever talked about.
We promised a number of issues back that you would teach us and the listeners of Wizard's Edge in their entirety how to look at the Wall Street Journal, how to look at the Forbes, how to look at the newspaper, USA Today, how to use those information sources as a means of generating new business ideas. My own observation is this is one of your most powerful techniques.
I think it's probably singularly the talent or the ability that has enabled me to accomplish as much as I have for as many people in as many unrelated fields. It's my one true advantage, my gift, if you will, that has allowed me to give almost any kind of a client that I've ever worked for a decisive edge, because I can see things that none of their competitors can. I'm able to migrate, borrow, funnel, whatever you want to call it, Marty, ideas and implications from outside. It's what I call the extrapolator's mindset, the interpreters or the importer or exporter's mindset, and it's a way of looking at life that once you learn how to do it in this very tangible environment, your mind gets disciplined to the point where you can easily do it in an intangible. In anything you're doing, you can easily modify it to where you experience something in life and you adapt. It's a real interesting process. I have had as my mentors people who have allowed me to watch what they've done, and some of the brightest, most intelligent people I have ever worked with became masters at this. They recognized that one great idea properly borrowed could make them millions or tens of millions. They recognized that most people do not possess enough original idea-generating capacity, but that almost every human being possessed an infinite ability once it was learned of how to modify, apply, borrow, adapt, adopt, import, or interpret what somebody else has already perfected in another industry or life or business application. Let me try to summarize what that means. It means that coming up with breakthrough ideas is a very difficult process if you try to create them from scratch. Observing, identifying, monitoring breakthrough ideas other people have already come up with, and then modifying them to your own business application or usage is really an easy process. And what I learned from the masters that I study with, Marty, is that your goal in business is to get leverage, the highest and best use of your efforts. It's much easier to take something that has already worked in some other arena and modify it than it is to come up with a breakthrough that's never been perfected and then perfect it. Because the truth of the matter is, when you come up with new ideas, the vast majority do not work. When your stock and trade is proven, profitable, existing ideas, it's real easy to make massive profits.
Okay.
So I'm a pragmatist. I'd rather deal in things that have about 10 times more probability and certainty.
Okay. Can you teach us how to do this, number one, and can you put it in a compact enough format so that we can grasp it?
Yes, and I hope to do it in all of about 30 or 45 minutes. It's not a hard process once it's broken down to its basic core.
All right. How are you going to develop this? I know you're going to be dealing with some of the best-known publications. Will you teach us first? Will you give us examples first? How do we learn?
I'm going to give you two life examples, and then we're going to do a little bit of work together.
All right.
Okay? So two life examples that make it real clear. First of all, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine named Howard Ruff was reading the Wall Street Journal. He saw in one of the second section articles on the front of the section a fascinating story about a restaurateur in Kansas who had abandoned his fixed menu pricing and had instead a simple offer that he basically made to any customer that came in. Pay me whatever you think the meal is worth. The man tried it years before and found to his fascination that because his food was so good, his service was so outstanding, his environment and ambiance was so neat, that many people paid more than he would charge. Almost everyone paid at least what he would normally want to charge. Consequently, he came out better than he would if he put pricing on the menu. Okay, Howard Ruff read this article about a restaurant. Howard Ruff was in the newsletter business. Howard Ruff didn't say, well, okay, good for him. He came up with a breakthrough, but what can I do for myself? Instead, Howard Ruff's mind automatically said, what is it about what that man has discovered that I might be able to adapt or incorporate into my daily business activities? And he asked a lot of questions. Could I do it in my normal activities? And his normal activities were newsletter subscription mailings. Howard felt that that would probably be too hard to do in the initial stages because his new subscribers didn't have any experience with his newsletter. They didn't really know what it was worth. They hadn't gotten it on a regular basis. They hadn't listened to it, read it, followed the advice, invested on his recommendations, and made a profit or saved their capital from danger, so they couldn't really appreciate at the highest levels what it was worth. But he had a lot of different segments to his operation. What he realized, however, was that in renewal, it had incredible applicability because he could tell somebody, look, pay me whatever you think the newsletter is worth, and he could give them a slight floor on their valuation understanding by saying, but bear in mind before you decide that we do have a staff of 25 people and a payroll of $200,000 a month, that we do basically have wire services connecting us with 15 different market exchanges around the world, that we do have 12 mobile researchers who are always in the field visiting public corporations, going into the mines, looking at their reserves before we ever will reserve. Bear in mind that we have a computer that costs us $2 million that keeps track of everything. And with those understandings, feel free to pay whatever you like, bearing in mind that comparable newsletters do sell for $200 to $500 a year. He set some bases so it wasn't just blind.
Mm-hmm.
And he got on average, as I recall, and this is just my memory, something like $80 from people, and his newsletter was normally going to price at $69.
Interesting.
That's one thing. The next thing is years and years and years ago, I was reading a copy of the Los Angeles Times. I live in Los Angeles area, and I was reading a Sunday Times. There was an ad in the Times for a company that was offering gems for $5 a piece, and they admitted in this offering that they were not full-blown gems. They were little fragments, but they were real emeralds and real sapphires and real ruby particles, and they were offering them as an introduction to what it was like to own a precious stone. It was a very novel and interesting and powerful approach. It was doing well because I saw it repeated over and over again, and I did a little research, and I queried a number of my friends and investigated and found that people in the know knew that these people were generating tens of thousands of new customers every week, not month, but week, and that a large number of those customers ended up buying more expensive items after they got this nominal introductory gem.
Okay.
So I asked myself, how could I modify or apply that same philosophy? And it was a marketing test philosophy. The basic ad said, emeralds for only $5 as part of a daring test we are making or trying. I can't remember the exact language. So I said to myself, what can I do like that? How can I apply what that concept is to my work, to my activities? Most of my activities were either for investors, for precious metals dealers, or for newsletter publishers. What I did was very simple. Number one, I derived that approach into a promotion I used for a number of lesser-known but very qualitative newsletters. And what I did was this. I came out with something I called the marketing test approach for newsletters, and the headline would say something to the effect of $195 newsletter on sale for only $19 as part of a daring test we are trying. Another approach I did was I tried it for investment-grade introductory rare coins. What I did was very simple. I wrote an ad, and it said, Morgan silver dollars on sale for only $19 a piece as part of a daring test we are trying. And in the body copy, I gave reasons why. The reason why is we want to introduce people to both the newsletter in that application and the rare coin in that application. I told people that we felt that if they got the various referred product in their hands and they started using it, studying it, appreciating it, the odds were exceedingly high that they would end up wanting to buy many more at full rate, whether it be more years of the newsletter or more coins, because they'd see the value. That simple application of an already proven idea generated for me 900 or so subscriptions. Maybe it was only 860, but almost 900,000 subscriptions at $19 and $20 a piece, and produced for me about a $3.5 million profit in 6 months, just because I was mindful enough and observant enough and lateral enough in my ability to interpret and connect what somebody else had discovered, refined, perfected, and proven in one business arena and modify and import it into my application.
Okay, that's thrilling and it's exciting, but the problem, as you know, with examples is they're not repeatable.
Well, but they really are.
Oh,
they really
are.
Let's just take those two before we go on.
Okay.
Okay. I just said that Howard Ruff saw that a restaurateur did a name your own price. See, what you're responding, no offense, is you're showing a literalist mentality. I want to show a lateralist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Literalist, lateralist. A lateralist would say, how many ways and what products or services could I offer a customer a name-your-own-price option on, given the fact that either A, I had massive profit in it, or B, I had not much profit, but if I got somebody started by buying that, the odds were they'd buy a lot more of those, or buy larger versions of those, or buy those over and over again, or C, if I get people to buy that, the odds are they're going to buy other products from me that complement at very high profits to me.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it's a lateralist, not a literalist.
Hmm.
Big difference. Same thing with what I said, the marketing test. People used it after I did it many different ways. A software company tried offering $500 software for only $29 as part of a test, and the rationale was, they felt like if you bought the software and applied it and used it, you'd want additional software at full rate and you'd want all the updates at full rate. I had a health club that did a modification of my concept. They were able to offer six-month subscriptions to the health club for only $19 as part of a test with the same rationale. They knew if you came in and you started working out, the odds were good that you'd keep your health club membership intact and would renew at full rate at the end of the six-month period. Does that make sense to you?
Okay, yeah.
I've had numbers of service companies, maintenance companies that did maintenance around office buildings, land maintenance, yard maintenance, pool maintenance, heating and air conditioning maintenance, all used derivatives that I taught them of that same concept to get people started in their business, which was a perpetual business. In other words, once you get somebody on a maintenance program, unless their need changes or the quality of your service lessens, they're going to keep using you over and over and over again. And once you get them habituated or acclimated, the odds of them stopping using you are very low. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Jay, one of the things that I think most of us learn from is repetition. Can you outline some of the ideas you've seen from some of the articles you've read so we can get a flavor, maybe kind of think on our own how to do this?
Yeah, sure. I absolutely can. In fact, I just pulled a couple right off my table that I had marked up, and I'll just go through them and tell you what I'm talking about here, okay?
Okay.
I was reading People magazine the other day, and there was an article about a clothier that clothes 007, clothed Pierce Brosnan for the last 007 movie.
Okay.
And it was talking about them, and it talked about the fact that the reason they were so successful is that they really revere great garments and great fabrics. And I stopped and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder how many people revere or honor the real great components or engineering or technical prowess that goes into the creation and the production or the rendering of their product or service. And it went on. I'm looking at it, so bear with me because I'm looking and talking at the same time. It talked about that they promote elegance, not extravagance. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Because everyone else looks at a $7,000 suit as being extravagant. But their whole take is it has nothing to do with the money. It's how it makes you look, how it makes you feel, how it makes you act, how it makes you seen or perceived. I thought about how many different aspects of selling products or services or differentiation that kind of a paradigm shift might be very useful for. In the same issue, there was an article about an up-and-coming actor who has a very unique character role on one of the police stories, and it was chronicling his life, and it was very interesting. In one section, it says it was talking about him as a person and what made him come to note certain people in the industry and also some of his friends, and they said he pays attention to who you are. Bill always makes me feel more special than anyone. And I started thinking about the fact that in life, in business, in relationships, if you make someone feel more special, you are always more special to them. Whether you're selling to them, whether they are your employee, whether you're your vendor, whether they are your customer. Another section in the same article said, I was talking about his family, and he talked about the fact that one of his big issues he had, he went into acting because he had a background where they didn't talk about feelings in his family. Questions about personal matters weren't brought up. We didn't seem to ever talk about anything controversial. And I thought, that's a mistake. In business, in life, you should deal with issues like that. And I thought, how much deeper and richer would your relationships be with your customers, with your employees, with your vendors, and with your family if you dealt with feelings, how you feel about things, and about more deep personal issues, and made them feel like they were important enough that you'd share that. Is this kind of things making sense to you, Marty?
Yes, it is.
Let me go to a couple more, because I just picked a bunch of them out here. There's an article in one of the Wall Street Journals that I have on my desk. It's a headline that says, Sales Wars Help Buyers of Sedans Drive Bargains, and it talks about the fact that one of the car companies turned a dying sales trend into a 35% jump by offering a rebate. And then it talked about that they tried another company, offered a 4.8% financing, and another company gave money back to the dealers. And I thought, how frequently do we ever think about helping induce the customer by giving them rebates or giving them terms or better terms than market or giving incentive to our dealers or distributors to sell, particularly if we were selling a product or service, or our salespeople, if we were selling a product or service that had a residual sales factor attached to it, something that had repeat sales. And there was a section in this article that says, today there's no way you can launch a brand new product on the car side of the business without some kind of spiff or incentive on it. I started thinking, I wonder how few people really realize that the markets today have changed. People need to be incentivized. People need to be bonusized, if that word exists. People need to be ethically induced or ethically seduced by being given something so attractive that it's more appealing to buy than not to buy. And that appeals to everybody. That's an offer to people to buy from you, to manufacturers to sell to you, to salespeople to work for you, and across the board. See how I look at it a lot different than most people, don't I, Marty?
Yes, you do.
In the LA Times, there was an article about AT&T decided to invest in DirecTV instead of investing five times as much in satellite technology. It said that they made a very cautiously formulated decision that they'd get much more leverage by investing in the existing technology that was already up there and leveraging their money. And I thought, I wonder how many people are so hell-bent, if you will, on doing it themselves and starting things from scratch when, in fact, leveraging off of somebody else's already existing momentum, critical mass, or velocity could be so much more powerful. There's another article in another issue, I think it was Monday's, of the Wall Street Journal, about a prominent law firm, a promotion consumer-based law firm, I won't mention the name, that was going through a partnership split. And there were 7 different things I circled on one page of this 3-page article. For example, the first one was the fact that these people were one of the first law firms to advertise. And when they did, the California Supreme Court took them to court. Instead of bringing the case quietly down, that was the factor that singularly gave them more thrust. So whenever there's something controversial, sometimes embracing it head on and bring it to the public's mind and awareness is a real powerful promotional activity, because these people got something like $10 million worth of free advertising for their plight, and they would never have been able to afford $10 million because they were struggling to get started. I thought that applies to a lot of people. It talked about the woman who became the figurehead for the firm, and it was evident she was not the two founders, but they assigned a third party to become their spokesperson because she had the time and she had the enjoyment for media communicating, and she was media friendly, and she penned all kinds of books and reports, like 100 Tips About Love and the Law for people contemplating a divorce. And I thought, well, how many other people don't do things? They don't use the media. They don't do reports, books, things that will give them positive credibility and celebrity status because they don't have time, when, in fact, if they contract with them right and protect them and tie them to their business, you can bring on a third party to be your spokesperson, to do all these things, to hang out with the media if you're uncomfortable with it. You getting my point?
Yeah, yeah, making a lot of sense.
In the same article, it talked about that this company built their business by a hokey, lower market consumer positioning. And when they went into New York, everyone said, you got to be highfalutin and different. It won't work there. So they spent all this money on highfalutin stuff, and it bombed. And they went back to the same hokiness that they did before, and their business took off. And I thought, how many of us are so eager to be what we're not that we kill successful approaches, programs, marketing, advertising, positionings, market niches we have because we decide we're too good for it? It talked about the fact that they did their ads so crudely they could do them themselves, and they saved $50,000 a year just on productions. And I thought about a man I know in the infomercial business, and infomercials cost like $500,000 to make, and he made a hokey one that everyone told him wouldn't work in his localized TV studio for $10,000 and sold $40 million, and they tried making a very sophisticated one, and it pulled about a fourth as well. I thought, we're all trying to be so sophisticated that really the integrity of the message is more important than the carrier of it. If the message has integrity, down and dirty and right to the point and straightforward and a little bit hokey is very powerful, and I think we miss that. There's another part of this article that talked about that in the law you can't own a legal firm unless you're a lawyer. But it says these people figured out an ethical way around it by creating a management firm that sold management advice and services. And I thought, boy, that's an interesting business opportunity that probably applies to a lot of regulated fields. And I know that it does, but if I didn't know it does, that's what it would have taught me. The essence is this. You learn not to be a literalist. The critical distinction in life, as far as I'm concerned, Marty, between mediocrity and greatness is how you see and seize on insights, information, how able you are to perceive the implications, the applications, the opportunities inherent in somebody's seemingly inconsequential insight or assessment or reporting of something. I look at this. All the things that get reported in any kind of a reputable publication, meaning anything people pay good money for and respect, they're going to be either good things or bad things or interesting things. If they're good, they're things you can learn from. If they are bad, they're things you can learn not to do. If they are fascinating, they may be things that will add more spin. There's an article here, for example, about a big shopping mall company in Indianapolis that's experimenting with all kinds of entertainment devices to attract people. And the essence of the article says, today shoppers have so many people prevailing upon them, they have so little available time, and they're finding such mediocrity of fulfillment when they shop, they need another reason. They need a bigger experience than just going to buy a shirt or a tie. And it said that they're finding that by doing this, by providing entertainment, by providing an experience other than just the shopping, people are staying two or three times as long and buying three or four times as much. The implication to me there, Marty, is if you put more of an experience or an event or an entertainment or a fascination or not novelty in the but unexpected dimension to what you're doing, people will pay attention longer, they will revere it longer, they will spend more money and stay loyaler. Does that make sense?
Makes sense, as does most of what you say.
And I'm just basically, and I just learned to do that. And there was an article about a man today who took in like $25 million for a nonprofit foundation, used it for his own, got in trouble, went bankrupt. It was an exploitation type of an article. In the process, it talked about how he took in all the money. He took in all the money by offering to match it. He supposedly had all these well-heeled, anonymous benefactors who were going to match the donations he got from organizations and individuals. And I thought, wow, how can you use the concept of matching performance to motivate people? In other words, if you bought $100, I'll match you and buy you $100. If you sell $100, I'll match you and give you commission on another $100. And I just thought about all the twists because it motivates people. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's a very interesting idea.
So, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think the essence of what I'm trying to share is this. I probably am somewhat unique because I have disciplined my mindset to see and seize and draw out and interpret enormous, enormous implication into what I am reading. Most people have never had anyone challenge them to do that, but if you read an article, stop and say, line by line, section by section, issue by issue, insight by insight, point by point, opportunity by opportunity, what is there that I am learning that is something that I can use to be more successful or avoid becoming less? What is there that tells me about how humanity operates, the psychology of human nature? What is there that tells me how to excite or motivate or compel people? What is there that tells me I should do more of or should do less of? And then when you get those answers, then you pass it by all four categories of customers you deal with, because you have four categories of customers in your business life. Number one, the people who buy from you. Number two, the people who you sell to in the form of your employees, because if you don't get them compelled on your mindset and your philosophy and in sync with you, they don't perform. Number three, your vendors, and number four, your family and loved ones. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Makes,
okay.
Yeah.
So I am looking at the latest issue of Forbes. I'm just thumbing through it, all right?
Okay.
Okay, there's a section in Forbes called Follow Through. It's a summary, a little summary of the results of different businesses. Let's take two or three little articles, and I'll read them because they're all about four paragraphs apiece.
Okay.
Okay, it starts and says, Quaker Contrarians, says, remember last issue when we said Quaker Oats was on track to improve, and to improve Snapple, the beverage company? In late December, Snapple announced lower sales and earnings for the quarter and a $30 million restructuring. Predictably, the press and analysts trashed Quaker again for its cost acquisition of the tea and juice blends company. But there's no reason to panic. Despite the gloomy headlines, the market took it all in stride. Quaker stock dropped only a small percentage because Snapple was already expected to post a loss, and they were prepared for it. I'm summarizing here. These moves are in line with steps Quaker is taking to bolster Snapple, as we reported. The write-off relates mostly to obsolete packaging and the restructuring to buying out a third of its co-bottlers. At least one analyst thinks it's still a buy. So it's just an update. So what's in there? Well, first of all, if you read this, it talks about a company that, first of all, took the bull by the horns and took non-productive aspects of their business, bit the bullet, and took action by stopping things that weren't working, by updating and improving and making more market appealing packaging and products that they were selling, and by letting everybody in the marketplace know about it. Do you understand how I just interpreted what that said?
Yes.
Now, what could that mean to you and your business? I'm saying first thing you'd want to do is inventory everything about your business. You took this one article and said, how do you use this philosophy and springboard from that, right?
Okay.
How do you lateral from it? This is just a randomly chosen article, right?
Right.
What this article tells, most people read it would say, oh, that's interesting about Quaker. I say that's interesting about Quaker, but that's just the beginning. I say, what is it in this article that I can directly or indirectly use to benefit or bolster or improve my business successes or the performance of my business or any business I advise? Well, the first thing this tells me is that an astute business company, first of all, looks at the performance of their various products and services, and they decide, is there anything about what we are offering that is out of kilter to what the market wants? Are we offering an antiquated product or service, or are we packaging or presenting that product or service in an antiquated way? If we are, we better, first of all, recognize that, do something about it, bite the bullet, and stop it, because if it's trending down and it's not what the market wants, we should give them what they want and be more market satisfying, and we should take the bite if we can afford it and move on to a better position or a better packaging or a better presentation. We should also not do it covertly, but tell the marketplace. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I'm just going to randomly go through some articles and tell you what I get out of them, okay?
Okay.
There's an article here that says, it's talking about a guy named Ronald Lauder, who's an heir to Estee Lauder, the cosmetic company.
Okay.
It's a little box. It's got a picture. It says, going, Egon, E-G-O-N, which is a play. It's a guy's name, Egon, but it's using it in the to infer gone, like in an auction.
Okay.
In a disparaging profile of the Estee Lauder clan recently, the Wall Street Journal mocked Ronald Lauder, this man, for, among other things, spending $10,000 of his bar mitzvah money on a self-portrait by Viennese expressionist Egon Schiele. Such vanity. Such a waste of money. You should be so dumb. Sotheby's recently sold a strikingly similar Egon Schiele self-portrait. The price, a healthy $1.6 million. What it's saying is that value and worth are contained many different ways, and you've got to be willing to look beyond the surface. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This man, even at the young age of 13, recognized that there was an emerging value in an artist that was highly renowned and was probably older and on the verge of maybe dying. He recognized that looking just at fundamentals, if he got that person to create a painting of him, it probably would have value. Certainly it would hold its value, but more importantly, it could grow in value. Everyone else was looking at it superficially as an indulgent, you know, self-aggrandizing action, when in fact what this is saying is the guy was far more astute than that. He saw below the surface and he used that vehicle because he didn't have anything else for them to paint. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And there are lessons, and the lesson would be, what is there below the surface that has more value than I am realizing? And I'm going to take you to the next major article in here because it's pretty interesting. Is this helping to make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, could you give an example of how I might use that in a business, say if I was in the carpet cleaning business?
Yeah, sure. In the carpet cleaning business, what it says is that value has got many components. I'm interpreting what I get out of those articles. Value has many components. Current superficial component is only one. Long-term compounding value is an intangible component that has massive implication to almost anything you do. And I would add, in today's business, it's me editorializing, where acquiring anything like a customer from scratch is so terribly expensive that whenever however you can acquire something that has the capacity to build and compound in its future value, that is an essential strategic philosophy you have to incorporate into your business activities. What does it mean in the carpet? It means that a carpet cleaning company that knows a certain kind of a customer has the capacity to either repurchase frequently. For example, I have a lot of social activities. I have a very large house. It costs about $500 or $600 to clean our carpet. I have a lot of children. I have a lot of white and light carpets. They get dirty easily. We get them cleaned 4 or 5 times a year normally, and we get them cleaned before every time we have a social activity. That means that on an annualized basis, if I like you, I have the capacity of generating probably $2,000 or $3,000 worth of very highly profitable carpet cleaning business. I also hang out with people who have a lot of carpet and have a lot of light carpet and do a lot of socializing and have a lot of children. So they are like-minded and have similar interests, needs, motivations, and inclinations. And if I am happy with you and I use your service satisfactorily, the odds of me introducing you to other people are very high. I have offices in 2 different places. Those offices have carpets. Those offices have light carpets. Those offices have light carpets with a lot of floor traffic. Those light carpets with a lot of floor traffic get dirty. Those light carpets that are dirty need to be cleaned. We have them cleaned every time we have a major client or prospective joint venture come. We have it cleaned any time we think it looks tacky because we want it to be psychologically inspiring for the salespeople and the staff that work there. Does that make sense to you so far?
Turn the tape over now as we conclude the program on Side 2. Okay, so if I were a carpet cleaner and did something extravagant initially to get your business, that would pay off as time progressed.
I'm saying you've got to be willing to calculate the compounding residual value of a transaction or an event or an action, and most people just look at it superficially. Does that make sense?
Okay, makes sense. What's the major article there you're going to jump
into? It's about, you know who Warren Buffett is? You probably do where you are.
His house is not terribly far from our studios here.
Okay. Now, Warren Buffett is renowned as being one of the richest men in the world, and he's profoundly, profoundly known as being one of the ultimate buy-and-hold value strategists in the whole marketplace.
Right.
And the article in Forbes is not about Warren Buffett. It's about his partner, Charles Munger, M-U-N-G-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on to talk about 2 things. That Munger understood something that almost nobody else realizes. He realizes that in stock investing, there's 3 key factors that most people don't look at. Most people look at undervalued stocks, meaning stocks the marketplace hasn't fully recognized the potential of. He looked at stocks that the marketplace may have recognized the current potential of, but because of their positioning, product or service line, and inextricable involvement with the consumer or the business marketplace, it was impossible for them not to keep growing. For example, they invested in Coca-Cola when everyone thought Coca-Cola was fully valued, but they realized that Coca-Cola couldn't help but keep growing in underdeveloped markets. The Coca-Cola couldn't help being a key factor in the beverage community. they invested in See's Candy when everyone thought that no one would be in candy, but they realized that the predictability of people buying candy in the holiday time and at Valentine's time and at Christmas time and at certain key birthday events was almost certain. The predictability of people wanting to buy a low-priced gift to take to somebody when they did social or party activities was almost certain. That if the company had the lowest price cost to produce the highest or one of the highest images and great retail facilities, the odds of it enduring and growing were very high. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
They realized also that if you sell stock, every time you sell, you've got to pay capital gains tax if you have a profit. Mm-hmm. And that they realized that they could get greater yield by compounding their investment, by holding it and letting it grow and compound before they pay taxes on it. And it talks about all these things that the man realized, that they had chances to sell stocks. They had chances to sell the public some of the stock that they had bought, but they couldn't get as good a yield somewhere else, and it was compounding tax deferred, and that was really interesting.
Okay, yeah, I'm following you. I'm waiting for the Abrahamic extrapolation.
Of this?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it talks about, I'm going to give you a bunch of them. It talks about the fact that this man has got the ability to look at everything and evaluate the downside and see upside opportunities that no conventional investor has seen. It talks about the fact that their interpretation of value is a different definition than almost every other value-based investment mind in the planet. And I think that it goes along to the kind of thing that I teach. Value doesn't necessarily mean buying something worth a dollar for 80 cents. It means buying something worth a dollar and maybe even paying a dollar 10 because it'll keep paying off a dollar every day for the rest of your life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Like a customer or a salesperson or a piece of equipment or a location. It means not being, there's many different attitudes. There is a extreme bargain-based attitude that only buys people or equipment or products and services when you can get the very lowest price. There is a value-based philosophy that only hires people or equipment or products or experts when they can pay such a high cumulative dividend. And I'm saying there are different philosophies. I take a philosophy that says that going into business is so expensive, acquiring customers and operating is so expensive, that you have to adopt a philosophy like the one that Charles Munger or Warren Buffett has adopted, that basically is long-term, highest-yielding value, not buying assets cheap. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just I'm trying to give you interpretation. They look at what can go wrong. What have I haven't seen that other people have overlooked? These guys are extremely focused on how their downside is protected, how their exit strategy is assured. And most people in business today are deluded optimists, or they are what I call deluded pessimists. In other words, they don't do things because they're afraid it will go wrong, or they do too many things because they have diluted optimism. They don't soberly look at the downside in hedging their bet. I interpret what he's saying there as don't do either. Look at activities as always having great upside potential, but don't go into anything unless the downside is either controlled or known, or you have an exit strategy. And let me give you a specific example. Number one, we had at one of my training programs recently a relatively well-known, successful venture capitalist. He was a man whose firm raised money and invested in other people's businesses, startups, expansion activities, etc. He said everyone is wrong in the way they look at venture capitalists. They all go to him say, thinking that the venture capitalist is focused on how he or she can make 100 times their money. They said that is certainly a factor of importance, but far more important is your ability to convince me that you have my downside covered, that I have an exit strategy in place if what I am investing in doesn't work out, so that I know that my downside is very low or non-existent and my upside is very high and very predictable long term. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like the biggest thing that they said about Charles Munger that I think a business owner has to recognize on, because I staunchly talk about the recurring value of a customer on the repeat side, on the frequency of purchase, and the residual effect that they have on you. And this talks about his understanding, along with Warren Buffett's, of compounding interest tax deferred. In other words, they would invest in a company. The company would make a profit. The profit would be reinvested in activities that would grow that profit. That profit would accumulate. That value would accumulate. And they wouldn't have to pay taxes on that accumulated value and profit until they sold the stock. What does that mean to a business owner? It means that you want to invest in people, and you want to invest in relationships, and you want to invest in distribution networks, and you want to invest in endorsers and strategic alliances, and you want to invest in customers that will grow and prosper and buy more things and make you lots of profit on a compounding basis. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. Does the literalism tend to negate this kind of perspective?
I think most literalists, just they read something and they're either nonplussed or they're jealous or they're intimidated or they're angry or they're frustrated because he did it and they can't. They don't realize that every article about anything that is newsworthy, particularly in business, but in any aspect of life, has very, very powerful implications. I'm trying to think about an article that I read recently about an actor. I read an article about an actor. I do not remember who it was. He was telling about why he was so good. This was an older actor. He said he had basically been performing at a theater, and Al Jolson, back in whenever, the 20s and 30s, had come and attended his performance and had gone to his room afterwards, his dressing room, and had talked to him and said, kid, this guy was young then, there's two things you got to realize. The only way you're going to be greater than anyone else you perform against is if you practice more, if you cultivate your understanding, if you develop your performance capabilities at a higher level of discipline than anybody else. And it's impossible to do that by just doing what you do for 2 hours on stage. You've got to basically put 2 or 3 hours in the morning beforehand. You've got to put an hour after you've done it in debriefing yourself and asking, what did I do great that I must continue to do? What did I falter on, or what did I miscue on? What can I do better to make my counterparts, my colleagues on the stage with me, bring out more in me and I can bring out more in them, so the combined performance is superior? Now, I read that, and instead of thinking, well, so be it, I thought, well, what does that mean to me? What can I do to make my customers better? What can I do to make my suppliers better in their capability of contributing to me? What can I do to make my joint venture partners, my employees, my advisors even better at what they do for themselves and for me? Does that make sense?
It does, as most of what you say does.
Is it too esoteric for you?
Well, I was wondering, can we, I don't know who to take an example of. Do you want to do a little mini imaginary consultation?
Well, it's not a consultation. It's a facet of your being that you've got to basically recognized. Let me give you an example here. I'm looking at a section in Forbes that talks about money and investments. The headline says, Doctor Downsizing. When the smoke clears from healthcare, from the healthcare battlefield, there will be big winners and losers. And basically what it says here is that in HMOs and health management insurance companies, it's a bloodbath, but that the strongest ones are going to absorb and the ones that have unique strengths are going to endure and the other ones are not, but that the public is going to be benefited. And if you read it, you'll say, well, maybe I should invest in or not invest in HMOs. I read it and it says, look within your industry at who is strong and who's weak and who has certain skill sets others don't, and try to work arrangements where you can align with, take over from, become acquired by, or at least gain access to the key talents of certain people who've got strengths that are going to endure. The ones that are going to fall by the wayside know who their customers are and counter-program against them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of just interpreting things. I'm going through some other things here because I want to make my point really, really clear to you. So hold on 1 minute.
All right.
Okay. There's a story in here about a man who is making a fortune basically because he has figured out that in the computer business, the refills of the printers are more lucrative than anything else that anybody sells. And he's taken a position where he's commanded the market. Now, the question you have to ask is, what's that mean? Well, I interpret that as saying, what is it about your industry that no one else recognizes that's the hidden real profit opportunity that you can get to? Everyone else may be beating their head out to sell equipment for modest little margins, whereas some complement to that equipment may be the real profit area. And if you know that that's the real opportunity, shouldn't you be doing everything in your power to make it easy for people to buy the other parts so you'll get access to the really profitable transaction?
Mm-hmm.
Am I being too abstract?
I'm looking here. What are the consistent techniques that you use to elicit that? And my guess is the key question is, what does this mean? Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's the following. I think if I have to break it down to components, I'd say, first of all, what is the distillable driving principle or organizing principle, something Tony Robbins calls it, behind the essence of what that article is saying? What's making that story meaningful? What's making that man successful? What's the single most singularly important? There may be 7 points in the article. What's the single most significant point of that article about that man reduced down to its core principle? In other words, if it says Marty Stacey is successful at interviewing because he understands that there are 10 key questions that he knows how to ask in a progressive basis that gets people to summarize everything their life experiences are worth, and he knows that the order to ask them is such and such, and that the key way to do it is such and such, and I read that article, I would say, well, what's the organizing principle? The organizing principle is that Marty Stacey has realized that there's a way to interview people that reveals everything they know about something. And I'd say, what's the implication to me? And I'd say the implication is I can learn how to ask questions of people in other businesses that will reveal things that I can apply. I can ask questions of people who are more successful in my business and learn what they see that I don't. I can learn how to ask questions of people who may not be as successful as I am, but who most certainly do at least one thing better in their business that I maybe don't, that I've never thought about, that I've never focused on.
What I'm thinking about, Jay, is in some ways I see the success that you've had, and I'm saying, you know, can I or can the Wizard's Edge listener duplicate that, and I'm getting kind of caught in that.
Okay, well, let me say this. Don't think in terms of my success. Think in terms of your limitless opportunity and your very real limitation. If you hold yourself out and you decide what you want to do is come up with an infinite number of original ideas, the odds of you doing that are very low. Even if you do that, the odds of those original ideas being viable are at best 5 or 6%, meaning that 95 out of them, if you really try them out, if you put money and people and commitment and effort and time and passion behind them, most of them will fail. It's just a clinical or statistical probability. On the other hand, if you concentrate the bulk of your time and the bulk of your effort, Marty, on taking ideas, taking understandings, taking core principles that other people brighter than you have refined, developed, perfected, understood, applied, and can articulate, and you modify what it is about them that directly or most directly applies to you, the odds are about 90% if you get down to the core principle that they will work, because principles tend to be universal. When you identify the core essence or the driving principle behind a business's success or a person's philosophy success, they usually are principles that are universal. So if you assume that the principle, once you boil it down to its essence, will absolutely translate, but once you translate, it's almost like Star Trek. They would beam people up on whatever their whatever the thing was called, a transponder or whatever, okay. And you'd go from a solid form to a vapor form. You have to go back through and be reconstituted, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So think in terms of this. First thing you're trying to do is take something solid and break it down to its core essence. And then you're going to beam it over to your business. Then you have to reconstitute it in its application to you. Does that too confusing?
Yeah, no, that's clear. Now, let me, to use the Star Trek metaphor, I'm concerned about transporting so many ideas in so many different ways that I'm afraid I'm going to get lost and not get reconstituted.
Okay, so let's just start. Your goal should be this. Your goal should be from today forward to sit down with any publication and look at the core essence. Every article worth printing has some, I'm talking about major publications. In homespun publications, they'll put articles out that have no basis. Anybody who's paid any amount of money to write articles, and anybody who pays any amount of money to subscribe to articles demands value. Take that as an assumption, okay?
Okay.
So it doesn't matter whether it's entertainment. It doesn't matter if it's an article about a business achievement. It doesn't matter if it's an article about a archaeological breakthrough. Contained in the midst of that article is always, not sometimes, but always, Marty, going to be a core driving principle that is the point that either the person or the business the article is about has figured out, recognized, operates their business life or strategy by, or is using successfully, or, on the converse, some blunderous assumption or action that somebody made that absolutely was incorrect or erroneous. Will you accept that?
Okay, yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, if you're talking about somebody, most all articles are about something good or about something bad, aren't they?
Okay.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
It's axiomatic.
Isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's not about something that's in between, because it's not newsworthy. It's like saying Marty didn't do anything today is not newsworthy. Marty made $1 million by recognizing an aspect of radio that no one else recognized is newsworthy. Marty blew his radio station by not realizing that you have to keep selling customers over and over again is newsworthy, right?
Right.
So what you want to do is look at any article anywhere, and what you want to do is ask yourself, what is the core essence, the real principle that article is focused on? What is the driving philosophy that the person or the entity or the subject is all based on? And then this is the leap of faith and the connection and the bridge. What is it about that I can directly or indirectly apply to myself? Now, let's try another example, okay?
All right, let's do.
I'm sort of doing this from scratch. I'm just picking. I'm in the entertainment section of the Los Angeles Times now, okay?
Okay.
So let's see. How can we find anything that has any bearing there, right?
Right.
Okay, there's an article on the front page about Mobil Petroleum Corporation's commitment to public broadcasting's masterpiece theater and how it's been around for a long time, and that Mobil is trying to demonstrate its commitment to artistic quality and its importance in the changing entertainment mores by putting its name on top of it. It's also arguing whether that's good or bad from the non-commerciality of PBS. Now, what could that possibly have to do with our business lives, right?
What could that possibly have to do with our business lives?
Well, the first thing is that there are certain things about our industry or our business or our customers that may be losing its recognition or importance. For example, the concept of honoring your customer with respect and appreciation and attention and phenomenal service, putting their interest ahead of yours. Maybe we have lost track ourselves of an area within our industry or our business that we are not respecting and honoring, and maybe we better value it at a higher level. For example, a client I worked with one time had a rule that everyone in their company had to always talk every day about at least their major 20% of their customers in a positive way, talk about something good about them, and they sent a letter to one of their customers every day appreciating them, and they always look for something good they could do for their customer every day and making sure their customers felt honored. Now, maybe just reading that article would make, I mean, I read it and I would think, what is it about my industry or my business or any project within my business that I'm taking for granted, that it's getting stayed, that's becoming jaded, where I'm not really respecting or revering or articulating or acknowledging? And it could be a customer, it could be an employee, it could be a vendor. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And I just have disciplined my mind to ask questions. What is it about the S? What's that article saying? And what can that mean to me? And then I go categorically to my industry, looking for a void that other people don't see that I could see. To my business, looking for a void that I better see because I'm making a faux pas or I'm losing leverage. To my life, because maybe I'm screwing up in my relationship with my wife, with my children, with my neighbors, with my friends. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
So I'm just trying to tell you, and I'm just disciplined that I do this all the time. I do this all the time. I read every article everywhere I can in any qualitative media because I know that people won't pay unless there's a point. People won't pay unless there's a lesson. People won't pay unless there's an opportunity or an admonishment nestled in amongst the core essence of what that article is about. Normally, there is always one, and there are frequently multiple lessons and opportunities inherent there. And what I want to do is learn, what is it about that article? What is it about that person? What have they already screwed up on? What have they already spent years, decades, generations, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars to recognize that I can learn instantaneously in a reasonably clarified essence just by questioning, examining, microscopically analyzing the real driving essence, core principle embodied in that article, and then bridging it over to my industry, to my business, to my life.
This means that as I read the newspaper or the magazines, my whole life assumes more of a focus as well.
That's right. Now, everything, what I recommend you do is get a yellow pad or a journal or some kind of a spiral book. And every time you read anything, have a page for it and put in there at the top of the page the name of the publication and the reference date to where you saw it. In other words, the Wall Street Journal, Tuesday, January 23rd, second section, front page, third article. Then underneath I'd say headline, and I'd put it, subject, my interpretation of the subject from the literal sense. In other words, the article was about how the stock market was discounting short-lived fads. Then I'd say implication, and I'd say I'd use two things, the implication of the article, and then I'd talk about core principle behind the article, in essence, what it means to me. And then I'd act strategy or action coefficient or point, what I want to do with that. And then I'd value rank it on an immediate, a future, a primary, a secondary value to me. But I'd have it, then I'd have it co-routed in such a manner. I'd move it from that book where I wrote it down to primary, secondary, ancillary, tertiary status. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that answers the question. I had been kind of wondering as to how you control this.
But here's the thing. I believe in a very simple philosophy. If 99.9% of the people you compete against don't even understand how to do this, and when they read anything, they read it either as jealous literalists or as jaded literalists, and you're the only person in your industry that reads everything you can get your hands on in any valuable publication other than your own, because your own's already going to try to be literal.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be lateral. You want to read every kind of business, every kind of investing, every kind of industry, anything where there's steep competition, anything where there's extreme volatility, everything where there's dynamism, meaning lots of changes, lots of people trying to come up with breakthroughs, lots of people taking chances, lots of people doing deep, thoughtful reflection on factors, on interrelationships, on trends, on implications, where all the cumulative IQ and brain power and human and financial capital are brought to bear on something and condensed in all of a page or two or three, where all you have to do and realize that a writer may have spent a month or a year and thousands of dollars of his or her publisher's money flying off and visiting somebody who you could never get access to, who you wouldn't even know exists. And just by reading that article and interpreting and identifying the core driving principle, you could make a fortune or save a fortune or get a connection or make yourself many times a better communicator or manager or leader or visionary or hedger or father or mother. That's or lover or husband or wife. I think that's exciting, don't you?
Yeah, it is.
A point out, Marty, I want to make, it's really important. If nobody else in your industry or business begins to understand this, and I get you every day of every week realizing that you've got incalculable leverage by radaring right in on what all kinds of other people have figured out, good or bad, and knowing that 95 to 100% of those insights have direct or at very least indirect implication, application, benefit, or protection or enhancement in your business or personal life activities. And every week I get you to expose yourself to 100 breakthrough insights. Do you realize it doesn't matter if you forget 90 of them? It doesn't matter if you never get around to acting on the vast majority of them. One good idea acted upon has caused businesses to flourish, wealth to be amassed at incalculable levels, formidability to be created in such power that it just dwarfs all the competition. I don't much care if you don't recall the vast majority. I'm just trying to get this to be so habitual that you stretch and warehouse in your mind so many insights, so many understandings, so many deeper, broader, clear, more powerful connections of principle-based understanding of how to do things better, how to do things more efficiently, effectively, more profitably, safely, more leveraged on the upside, more hedged on the downside, by tapping into what other people have already done. Every article you read is the cumulative result of years, decades, dozens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people's activities, the efforts and the money mobilized of a magazine, of an individual, of an organization, of an industry, of a marketplace, of a country. Do you realize the leverage? It is profound, Marty.
I'm very impressed. I mean, this is a way to take the accumulated intellectual capital of someone for virtually no acquisition cost.
That's exactly right, and you can do it all day long. And if you are one of those people who perceive themselves too busy to go outside your industry and do this, or nothing is important to you except your industry trade journals, you're denying yourself a quantum leap. You're denying yourself geometric progression in your capacity, your capability, your skill set, your business competitive advantage, and your understanding of how to accomplish things in your business in a much more superior way. And I think that's shameful. That's pretty much it, Marty.
Jay, it's been great talking to you. As always, there's so many thoughts here to absorb. It's nice that we can listen to the interview again and again. I look forward to talking to you next time.
Thank you, and I hope this subject is a very, very conceptual one, but I can tell you that in my life, this particular ability has given me enormous financial, operational, and business advantage, because it's allowed me to readily tap in to millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars worth of knowledge, experience, investment, and the mindset of all kinds of very astute, very, very capable reporters who have traveled around the world spending weeks, months, years investigating, analyzing, piecing together facts to be able to summarize something that I'm able to sit and read and garner insights and implications from. I am not unique. I may have taken it to a higher level of competency and sophistication, but there's no one listening to this interview that can't start doing the same thing for themselves. And as you can see, it doesn't matter whether you're reading serious business stuff. It doesn't matter whether you're reading light entertainment fodder. It doesn't matter whether you're reading general information. It doesn't matter what you're reading if your mind is looking for implications and opportunities. Anyhow, that's my message.
You've been listening to The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. We look forward to talking to you next time on The Wizard's Edge. This is Marty Stasis saying goodbye for now.